It's really good to be with you, and thank you for taking the time to come and hear some of what I've got to say out of the experience in Northern Ireland. This is a very special time for me in the States. I have, over the last 3 years since coming to Coventry Cathedral, got to know the team at Trinity Wall Street and at St. Paul's Chapel in particular. St. Paul's Chapel is a member of our community of the Cross of Nails at Coventry Cathedral. And this is the third annual visit that I've made to them, not always in the 9/11 anniversary, but it was a real privilege to come and to share with them this weekend in the various services that took place. I know there was a lot of controversy around the lack of a religious figure at the actual site itself, but let me assure you, as that morning went on, in all the churches surrounding Trinity Wall Street itself, St. Paul's Chapel, various Catholic and Protestant churches in the immediate neighbourhood, community churches, there were dozens of services taking place involving various people and praying on the day and reflecting on that. I go from here back up north again to Hartford, Connecticut, to the North American Board meeting of the Community of the Cross of Nails. It's interesting that an organisation which began in Coventry had its first ever international office in Atlanta, in St. Philip's Cathedral, when the Community of the Cross of Nails was finally formed as an organisation, took on organisational form, its first office was in the cathedral here in Atlanta. And so it's nice to be in the city that, or near the city today, but yesterday in the city and going back there tomorrow, that actually was part of the birth of the Community of the Cross of Nails in Coventry. I've been asked not so much to speak about my current ministry with Community of the Cross of Nails and Coventry Cathedral, but out of my experience in Northern Ireland. And I've given as my topic on the far side of revenge, lessons for healing the wounds of history. And in many senses, it does fit in with my work at Coventry, because one of the goals of the Community of the Cross of Nails is to helping churches address the issue of healing the wounds of history, wounds that still fuel so many of our conflicts around the world. In fact, there probably is not a single conflict that takes place that does not have its deep roots somewhere in relationships between nations and peoples from the past, that is still alive and poisonous today. And indeed, Northern Ireland was one of the first places that Community of the Cross of Nails engaged with very constructively as the conflict erupted there in the 1960s. And so I want to reflect with you some of what I've learnt from my experience as a peacemaker. I describe myself as a reflective practitioner as opposed to an academic, although I've done my statutory theology and peace studies, degrees and masters. And I also describe myself as a socially engaged theologian. That's how I like to think of it, rather than somebody sitting in academia. Someone has defined a socially engaged theology as, rather than applying Christian teaching to society, which is how we normally approach things as Christians, a socially engaged theology tends to ask what questions arise for the church from society with which theology then engages. So it's not us sitting in our cocoons, safety of church, or standing on our pedestal, saying, how do we apply our teaching to society? It is about getting down and dirty in society and saying, what questions arise for the church from this place with which my theology must engage? And I want to suggest to you that there's no more important question for the church of our time than the issues of war and peace, of violence and conflict. In Europe, you do not have to look further than the battlefields of the Western Front of 1914-18 to understand the rapid secularization of the continent. As the young men and some young women of Europe were slaughtered with the blessing of God, or so it seemed, as their countries marched them to war for God and country. And many of them came back from that experience not wanting to talk about God ever again. And so issues of war and peace, the experience of violence, of being caught up in that, present some of the most fundamental questions about how we be Christian in our societies in relation to our states and countries. And that's what I want to reflect on today out of the experience that I've had in Northern Ireland. And I come very much shaped by that. I cannot not be shaped by that. And forgive me if some of what I've got to say maybe comes with that sort of tinge of cynicism that we Irish sometimes bring to affairs as I reflect on what I think we need to engage with as we think about helping our world move beyond the point where they think they need to take revenge for the hurt that is done. As Gandhi says, an eye for an eye will leave the whole world blind. How do we stop this cycle? What does our faith have to say to it? And I want to leave you with just six thoughts and hopefully finish in time for you to come back with lots of questions. The propositions here will be straight and to the point, and we can explore them and open them up in response to questions and dialogue. But six simple points that come from my experience of working in Northern Ireland. The first thing is this: it's always political. It is always political. I suppose the church has a reputation of going to two extremes. You either over-politicise faith and wrap your faith in the flag of whatever country, or you go the opposite, that faith becomes a matter of personal piety and isn't applied at all to the public sphere and to the world of politics. But if we were to engage with the issues of war and peace, we need to get our head around the fact that it is always political. And my simple definition of politics is this: politics is the art of negotiating relationships. Simple as that. It is the art of negotiating relationships. It's the art of living in community. It's the art of living as the polis, as the people. And in a real sense, all of us are involved in politics. You're involved in politics. I'm sure you know about it in this campus and in the faculties. I'm sure you know about it in the local church, you know, local church politics, family politics, generational politics. We're always in a constant state of negotiating relationships. And nations and peoples, even these states of the United States of America, are in a constant state of negotiating relationships with each other. How do we agree to live with each other and to share the space that we occupy? And in that negotiation of politics, there are two things that come to the fore that go to the heart of why we have conflict. One is the issue of power. Now, I'm going to have to say that word again, because now that I'm living in England, I realise how my Irish accent affects how I say the word power. It's P-O-W-E-R, power, as they would say in England. But in Ireland, we say it like we've just hit the proper score in a golf course. Power. Because at the heart of every negotiation of relationship is the issue of control, is the issue of who owns the land, who controls the resources, whether they be commodities and money, whether they be natural resources of water, of agricultural land, whether it is about power and control over others through the law, whether repressive or good. All our relationships are all about power. And we all know who holds the power in our families, in our faculties, in our churches. And we all know the challenges of negotiating relationships between nations over these issues of land and resources. And it is that equation that makes the negotiation of relationships difficult. And the second thing that feeds into that and makes politics difficult to do in our world is the issue of identity. It is not just about power. If the first right, human right, is the right to life, the second human right is the right to sustain life, and that's about power. The third human right is the right to free association, and that's about issues of identity. Who we belong to, who is ours, the boundaries between peoples is a profound issue of human negotiation. Tribalism. whatever you want to call it. And when you think about it, all of us today, we all need a sense of belonging and boundedness. On a personal level, if we didn't have a sense of personal boundary, none of us would be sitting here. We'd be locked up in white rooms somewhere. So I'm not saying it isn't a good thing to have a sense of boundedness to our people. We know who our families are, who our neighbourhood is, the people that we feel at home with. But the real problem is the distorted belonging that comes when the edges of that belonging meet the other, and rather than being a place of encounter and of enrichment, it becomes a barrier and a barricade where we seek to destroy the other, which we don't understand. And nearly every conflict in our world has its roots in issues of identity. Who belongs and who doesn't? Whether that identity is defined by a political ideology, a religious belief, an ethnic descendancy, that is what fuels our conflict. And you just scratch under the surface, whatever reason is given, and you will see old-fashioned tribalism, whether defined by ethnicity or politics or religion. And in that sense, this is what we as Christians need to get our head around if we are going to address the conflicts of our world today, is the challenge of that political negotiation. The second lesson that I want to leave with you, and this is a hard one, I believe, for those of us as practicing Christians to get our head around, is bad religion always trumps good religion. I'm sorry, but it does. This side of the parousia, bad religion always trumps good. Because bad religion has easy answers. Bad religion has answers that seem to fix it and make the world simple. You will be aware through our Christian discipleship that the struggle for us is against the world, the flesh, and the devil. I like to think that the struggle for us corporate as the church is not so much against the world, the flesh, and the devil, but against God, land, and nation. The sort of bad religion that says God is on our side. The sort of bad religion that says this land is God's land. The sort of bad religion that says our people are God's people. When we know that Jesus said God's people are those who hear his word and obey him. When we know that the Bible says the whole earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And that we know that God's question to us is not whether God is on our side, but are we on his? And today there's Iraqis and Afghanis and Sudanese and Congolese and Somalis and Yemenis and even Saudis who are actually on God's side. All these peoples that we in the West can so easily see as our enemy. But bad religion starts defining those issues and is seduced by that temptation of God, land, and nation. It is the Constantinian sin that those of us who are Anabaptists or Baptists always like to remind the rest of the church they fell into at about the 4th century AD. And that is what we're up against. And so in Northern Ireland, the tragedy was that those who claimed to know Jesus best were often those who hated others the most. Because God was on their side, they were the people, and this land had to be defended to the last drop of our blood because it was somehow special to God. And he couldn't contemplate a united Ireland, otherwise Protestant evangelical faith would collapse. And until the church repented for that religious nationalism, then there was no way that it could be the peacemakers that God had actually called us to be. And part of the growth of the peace movement, particularly within evangelical Protestantism, came through a recognition that our sin of religious nationalism needed to be repented of. It wasn't just the Irish Catholics. Mary, Queen of the Gales, pray for us was the slogan of the Irish rebellions of 1916. But it was the Ulster Protestant evangelicals with their For God in Ulster that was equally the bad religion that needed to be repented of. So it's always political. Bad religion always trumps good. And the one quote I'll leave you with that is the one that Will Willimon, the Methodist bishop of Alabama, has put out this week in reflection on 9/11, that all preachers share in the shame, because when our people were vulnerable, they clung to the flag and not to the cross. And that is the challenge of the church everywhere, in being seduced by bad religion. The third thing that I've learnt from my peace work in Ireland is that we're all responsible. I'm a great fan of musical theatre. I love it. So much so that my wife the other year for my birthday bought me a book called What Would Barbara Do? How Musical Theatre Saved My Life. And it was basically putting together quotes, obviously Barbara Streisand, and putting together quotes from all musical theatre of all the little answers to life's problems. And it's amazing. When you do a new hermeneutic of musical theatre, it blows your head away. Oklahoma is a wonderful musical. The National Theatre in London did a version the other year. If you get it in DVD, it is really dark, because it brings out these issues of conflict and identity, of land and belonging. The cattlemen and the farmers, and all of that struggle over land, and of course South Pacific. And there's a wonderful song in South Pacific, which Mandy Patinkin does an amazing version of in one of his albums. But the song is, I'm sure you remember it, you've got to be taught to hate and fear, you've got to be taught from year to year, it's got to be drummed into your dear little ear, you've got to be carefully taught, you've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. Wonderful song of social justice. And the truth of our existence is that whenever we look at conflict as it manifests itself in our world today, particularly identity conflicts like Ireland, like the clash between the Arab world and the West, we are all responsible. We have created a world where we live in fear of the other, where we don't know the other, where we teach each other to be suspicious of the other, and we don't give the careful attention to the other that I believe Christian faith calls us to. At the heart of pastoral vocation is the whole concept of the cure of souls. Are we curious about the other because God loved them, because they're made in the image of God, because his love for them is as great as his love for us? I used to stand in front of audiences of good evangelical Protestants at home and try to convince them, hopefully relatively successfully, that God loved Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, the head of the IRA, as much as he loved them. And if they didn't believe that, they needed to go and read their Bibles again. God loves the head of Al-Qaeda today as much as he loves you. That's why the gospel is so offensive. That's why the gospel is offensive to the religious nationalist leaders of Jesus' day, because Jesus came and said, God loves the Gentiles as much as he does you Jews. And you need as much grace to be saved as they do. That's even more offensive. That I need as much grace as a terrorist to get into heaven? Absolutely. No more or no less. That, to me, is the good news. It certainly was the good news that I learnt as a child. And when we see the world from that perspective, we're all responsible. But don't get me wrong, we may all share responsibility for the world of suspicion that we've created. But of course, people are culpable for their actions. Because some people respond to that division through wanting to reach out, to make a change. Others respond with violence and hate, and they need to be held culpable for their crimes. So I'm not preaching an easy justice here. Far from it. But we will never understand it. We will never bring about an end to the perpetual conflict that our world seems to be settling into, unless we get this perspective that we're all responsible, and we therefore need to take a step in the direction of reconciliation to address these issues. My fourth reflection: history matters. It really does. And unfortunately, those of us in the West live in a culture that is becoming increasingly historically illiterate. The anger from the Middle East did not just begin with Gulf War I, nor did it just begin with the finding of oil in the Middle East in the early part of the 20th century. My grandfather served in Mesopotamia in the 1921 campaign to actually create Iraq. And the reason why Churchill and the British government wanted to get into Iraq and to determine what the shape of that should be was because Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, was moving the whole British fleet from coal to oil. And he needed to control it and to secure it. And that history matters because the British became the first to gas the Kurds. They dropped gas bombs left over from the First World War that should have been destroyed to put down the Kurds in the northwest because they didn't have enough troops to control them. And then we wonder why people in that part of the world see through our hypocrisies. History matters. When I visited Israel-Palestine earlier this year as part of the Community of the Cross of Nails, meeting with some of our partners in Ramallah and Nablus, I had to spend a whole hour listening to a range of religious leaders in Nablus tell me about the sins of the British in the Middle East. And was I going to apologize for the Balfour Declaration and all that had happened since oil was discovered in the Middle East? And history requires us to look at the wounds and the ancestral voices that call people to vengeance as opposed to forgiveness and reconciliation. Mark Bloch, a German historian and theologian who was martyred under the Nazi regime in 1944, says, "Once an emotional chord has been struck, the limit between past and present is no longer regulated by mathematically measurable chronology." Think of it in these terms. In Ireland, we like our history. We like looking back. But if you look at a genealogical table of where you've come from, in the space of maybe five relationships where you could have a conversation with a great uncle, who had a conversation with a great aunt, who had a conversation with a great grandfather, who had a conversation with a great grandmother, in five stories, you can cover 200 years. If your family have been blessed with long genes, longevity genes. So 200 years is not time, it's relationship. It's the story that's kept alive. The reason why Irish America funded the IRA throughout the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s is because when they all came to America from Ireland in the mid-19th century, they brought with them the story of the famine and English oppression. And that was the definitive narrative that they kept alive in their families. So when the IRA turned up in 1968 and said, "This is the next generation for getting the Brits out of Ireland, give us your money," they did. Without any critical reflection on how things had changed since then. These ancestral voices call on us to act in ways that do not make for peace. And if we are to deal with history, then there are three things we need to do. There needs to be hard telling. We need to start saying it as it is, not as the myths that are passed on through our ancestral voices. There needs to be an honest remembering, remembering the sins of our people as well as the offence of the other. And that remembering can only take place in the presence of the other. It's very easy to tell the American story or the Ulster Protestant story in a group of Americans or Ulster Protestants. But to sit and tell the American story or the white American story in a group of Native Americans or African Americans, you have to think very carefully about how you're going to tell your story. Because their experience of it will be very different. And honesty only comes through that. Fifth point. Peace offends. You might find that surprising to hear from a peacemaker, but one of the most profoundly thankful moments of my life and one of the most hurtful and traumatic moments was standing at the bottom of the steps in the Great Hall of the Northern Ireland Parliament and watching Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley walk down the steps together as First and Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland. While Dr. Paisley never killed anyone or commanded a paramilitary organisation, his political intransigence, combined with Martin McGuinness's career in the IRA, they were probably the two people most responsible for ensuring that Northern Ireland suffered 40 years of violence. The deal that they had just signed up to had been on the table since 1972. It really had, in all effects. And here they were in 2007, and thousands of lives later, signing up to it. It was offensive. I stood beside the leader of the Constitutional Nationalist SDLP, Mark Durkan, who had taken over from the Nobel laureate John Hume, and he was crying because his party had lost out for the extremists to do the deal. And yet he was thankful it was being done because he saw stability ahead. But it hurt. And if you think that peace is a nice sentimental thing and that peace with the Arab world is going to feel good, it isn't. There's going to be something profoundly offensive about it because, see, peace is based on the premise that enemies become friends. And when enemies become friends, it never looks nice. And it doesn't actually feel good in the immediacy of the moment. I'm going to explore that later in our questioning. And my final reflection is that reconciliation is elusive. We like in the church to talk about reconciliation as if it was something that is actually achievable in God's economy, this side of the parousia of Christ. I don't think it is. We're never going to resolve the conflicts of our world. We can work to transform them from violent conflicts to conflicts that are engaged in through politics and dialogue, but we're not going to resolve them. In Northern Ireland, there are still 1 million people who want to be British, and there's still about 800,000 people who want to be Irish. And the people of Northern Ireland have no settled will about the constitutional nature of the state or the legitimacy of the state. All we've managed to do in the last 20 years is agree that we're going to try to resolve that problem through dialogue and not through violence. But we're still a long way from resolving it. And there are many tensions and challenges ahead. And so we are a people who are being reconciled. We're not yet reconciled. Nor are we able to ignore the differences that exist in our world. Reconciliation, this side of the parousia, is not going to mean those differences are going to go away. And I would suggest to you that even afterwards, Revelation shows us that people from every nation, tribe and language, those differences will still be part of who we are. They will now be redeemed in Christ. I will be in glory as a white, male, Ulster Protestant who lived at the back end of the 20th century, first end of the 21st century. That will be my personal experience that will continue to shape who I am in my redeemed self. And that will be reflected in the wonderful diversity that will then be part of the kingdom. And certainly reconciliation is not going to mean that we forget the past. We cannot forget that past. We need to remember it and choose to forgive rather than act out of vengeance and revenge. That's why the title of my talk is In the Far Side of Revenge. That is what God calls us to, but it's an elusive quest because it's always contingent. Just think of your own life. At the moment that you feel most reconciled to God as you confess your sins and are assured again of his forgiveness and renewal, within seconds sometimes, the thought can creep in, the remembrance of a hurt, that suddenly your reconciliation with God is broken and you're starting all over again. It's always contingent. So I like to talk about living into what is to come. Not some elusive dream that we can achieve it. But we are bearing witness to the one who will bring peace and reconciliation when he comes again. We are living into it as his followers. But we must always remember that it is a quest. It is a journey. And it will always be elusive. And requires the best of our energies, intellectual and physical. We need to wage peace as critically as we learn to wage war. So my 6 points of reflection, and I've managed to do it inside 30 minutes, I've even surprised myself. It's always political. Bad religion trumps good. We are all responsible. History matters, peace offends, and reconciliation is elusive. And I'm sorry if I haven't given you a little sound bite that makes it all work. This is a hard job, and one of the things you can do for your students is to instill in them that they are a generation that has probably been confronted with one of the greatest challenges that humanity has to face. How do we learn to live together in a world that is now a global village, where you meet the other not 2,000 miles away, but 20 yards down the street, in your neighbour who has come to live from Somalia, from Nigeria, from India? How do we make that work when the history of hurt is so deep and so painful? And if the church can't do it, then God help us all. Over to you.
Have you worked with Father Ray Helmick?
Yes, I know Ray very well. I normally stay with him when I'm in Boston, him and his brother.
I had the meeting last fall.
Yep. Yeah.
And trying to forge the peace there.
And also over the years, we've all rubbed off against each other. It's quite a small community.
Yeah.
There's a broader community of sort of political scientists who get involved in all of this, but those who are theological and church-based is actually quite a small community. So we've all met each other and talked this thing out. So you do hear a reflection of what Ray says. Look, one of the interesting challenges that where my own thought is going at the moment, mainly through my wife's input, she's a feminist theologian and writer, and she's just delivered a paper back in Ireland at a conference on the other, actually challenging that assumption in Christian theology. The other is very much a sociological, political construct, and very popular today, whereas the Bible actually talks about the stranger, not the other. And that's a very different theological construct, and she was given a paper on that, and that's begun to open up a different angle on it. How do strangers become friends? So the Bible is less diffuse than this vague concept of the other. It talks about strangers and enemies, so it's very specific, so you can't get away from its focus. But yes, this whole thing of how do we relate to what is outside of us is a big part of it.
And your talk today really focused more on intercultural conflicts. How are the challenges different or perhaps more pronounced for interpersonal relationships, especially with a family that's
Yeah. In one sense, the principles aren't. I'm very conscious that the whole discipline of peace studies, as it arose in the 60s, actually drew very heavily on two things. Industrial relations, certainly in British academy, it drew on industrial relations and the whole issue of family and personal counselling. And so there's almost a cyclical sense in which it's now going back into it again. So some of those issues around identity and belonging, in a marriage, it is about control, it's about power, it's about having not over-dependent on the other to give you your identity, to have a sense of self so that you can then give self to the other. All of those issues are all part of that. The challenge, I think, for those of us who work in the more social-political side is one of my frustrations when I first went into peace work and community relations work in Ireland was there was almost an unwritten assumption that you would only get a peace process happening when everybody had been through a personal therapy session. And that's not going to happen for 1.5 million people. So you somehow have to plug in to the political power and to get political leaders to make big gestures and statements that are game changers, because you can't wait for 1.5 million people to have the therapy before they all stop killing each other. It's, you know, I'm overstating, but you get the point. So I think there is that tension, but a lot of the groundwork stuff that you do in peace work and how you do your workshops using Gestalt theories and other things, it is about people getting a sense of who they are and then how they relate to others and how that works at a community level as well. So there's a lot of overlap, absolutely, yeah.
In your experience, obviously, you had very violent conflicts between different religious groups there, and maybe there were some similarities within the U.S., but there was the conflict, not violent, but there was still animosity.
Mm.
Is there any advice that you have for somebody or people within here where it's not as open, but still may exist?
Yeah. This is one of those angels fear to tread moments. I spent 6 months in Duke back in 2006 as a visiting practitioner fellow at their Center for Reconciliation, taught a class on these very things, and at the end of my 6 months, the class asked me on my reflections of now having lived in America as a self-confessed Americanphile, you know, I love the United States. And the first thing I said, and probably the one that raised the most discussion, is that white America should be thankful that black America found God. Because it seems to me that the anger and the justifiable anger that is there has been dissipated and directed because of that, because of faith, rather than AK-47s being pointed at you. And that then leads me on to say that, you know, my friend Chris Rice at Duke says, leaning on from Charles Marsh, that the most segregated hour in America is 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And you know, I think that is a challenge. Something needs to be done. And it's not just on one side. You know, I have many African-American friends in the churches here who, you know, they like their religion the way they like their religion and don't want, you know, to be those tight asses. Baptists, you know, they want to be who they are. So it's a two-way street. But somebody's got to do it because, you know, the American identity thing is changing. I heard a lecture at Houston when I was here earlier this year from somebody at Rice University looking, they've been doing this study over 30 years of Houston and the change in you know, now white and African Americans are the minority. Hispanics and Southern Asians, Indians, Pakistanis, are the growing population. So how does America renegotiate its identity? And what role does the church have in that? I think is one of the most critical questions you face as a country, as a friendly outsider looking in, because it is changing. I don't know if you've seen the movie The Good Shepherd, about the start of the CIA. And there's a wonderful scene in this where one of the historical figures who helped start the CIA goes down to Florida to meet with a mafioso after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. And they're on their balcony in this Florida residence. And the mafioso says, you know, we know who we are. We're Italian Americans. And the Irish know who they are. They're Irish Americans. And he reels off a couple of others. And he says, but who are you? He says to this guy out of Yale and skull and bones and CIA to his fingertips. And he just looks at them, the Matt Damon character, and says, we are America. In other words, everybody else is some label American, but they're it. And I think there's a massive renegotiation going on here, if I can say that as a friendly outsider. And my challenge is, where do I hear the voice of the church in that? Because if any group should be helping people to untangle these issues of power relationships and identity conflicts in creating what America can still be, it should be the church. And yet it is consumed by so many internal things and is not engaging in that public debate. And that people can say it's the most segregated hour.
Do you consider the Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland to be reconciled?
No, I don't.
What would it look like if they are?
What would it look like? Well, I can, in the analogy that I used of pointers of living into it, there was a young woman killed on honeymoon this year in Ireland, whose father-in-law headed a GAA team. The young policeman, Catholic policeman, who was shot by dissident Republicans earlier this year, who played GAA, Gaelic Athletic Football. And the father-in-law of this young woman who had been killed, who was a coach, you know, came and helped carry his coffin. Martin McGuinness and Peter Robinson, Ian Paisley's successor, turned up to the funeral. And you know, when you consider the history between Gaelic Athletic Association and the police in Northern Ireland, this was a moment, this is what reconciliation looks like. Now, it lasted for the funeral, but it was one of those moments when something rose above the mess and something was borne witness to. I think ultimately what it will look like is around something that's about to happen at Coventry Cathedral next year. Next year is the 50th anniversary of the new Coventry Cathedral when it was opened. And the Frauenkirche in Dresden, which is one of our partner churches in Germany, is going to present us with a sculpture for putting in the ruins of Coventry Cathedral as their gift for our 50th anniversary. We, in turn, are going to dedicate that sculpture to all victims of aerial bombing in conflict, civilian victims of aerial bombing, but especially those in Germany between 1940 and 1945. That will be the first time at Coventry Cathedral we will have any official memorial to what happened to Germany in the war. And it seems to me one of the symbols of reconciliation that we have is that we truly know that reconciliation has taken root and is real and sustainable when we demonstrate the capacity to memorialize our enemies' suffering. That reconciliation happens when we demonstrate the capacity to memorialize our enemies' suffering. So if I can, in Northern Ireland, that is proving impossible. If there's one issue we're more contested about than anything else, it's about how do we deal with the past, how do we memorialize the suffering. I was on the government commission that looked at all of that, and there's absolutely no consensus. Because people are saying, if you put up a wall with names, do you put the IRA men and the loyalist paramilitaries on, alongside the civilians and the policemen? And no consensus. And I would want to suggest to you that you will know that America has reconciled with Iraq when America is able to memorialize the 900,000 civilians who have died in Iraq since 2003. That, to me, goes to the heart of the journey of healing involved in reconciliation. When I'm able to memorialize my enemy's sufferings, I've now got it. What it was like to be them, and therefore that they're the same as me, and we suffer together by our violence. And we have still to do that in Ireland yet. So we've still got a way to go.
Thank you very much.